All right, folks, welcome back. We are moving on to part three of our series on the wonderful, heroic Jim Garrison, his book On the Trail of the Assassins, One Man's Quest to Solve the Murder of President Kennedy. Like I said, this is part three in our series. But we are moving on to chapter 5 in the book. Chapter 5 is entitled, Setting Up the Scapegoat. From our investigation so far, I knew that Oswald could not have shot President Kennedy alone, that some part of the intelligence community had been guiding him, and that someone had been impersonating him. In other words, he had been just what he said he was when he was arrested. A patsy. Precisely what force had set him up still remained to be seen. Part of the intelligence community was involved, but I had no idea how broad the base of the operation might be. It had always puzzled me why Oswald had left Dallas in April 1963 to spend the summer in New Orleans, only to return to Dallas again in October. But given what I had learned, this began to make sense. Clearly, if Oswald was being set up as a communist scapegoat, his close association in Dallas with the anti-communist white Russians had to be severed. Likewise, a summer of ostentatiously handing out pro-Castro leaflets in New Orleans reinforced the image of a crazed communist assassin. In the intelligence community, there is a term for this kind of manipulated behavior designed to create a desired image. It's called sheep dipping. It seemed to me that Oswald had been in New Orleans to be sheep dipped under the guidance of Guy Bannister, and that he had been sent back to Dallas when the mission was accomplished. To see if I was on the right track, I studied more closely Oswald's return to Dallas in his last 2 months before the assassination. On September 23, 1963, a pregnant Marina Oswald and her daughter left New Orleans. They were driven westward to Dallas, I learned, by Mrs. Ruth Payne. It was generally agreed that Lee Oswald left approximately a day later. There were indications that he departed from New Orleans by bus, but that remained unconfirmed. For the moment, I concentrated, leafing through the large blue volumes to which I had become so accustomed, on the role of Ruth Payne in taking Marina Oswald and her daughter to Dallas and getting them set up there. Lee and Marina Oswald had met with Ruth Payne, in February 1963 at a party in Dallas, to which George de Morenschild and his wife had brought them. I found that Ruth Payne was the wife of Michael Payne, an engineering designer who did highly classified work for Bell Helicopter, a major Defense Department contractor. Ruth Payne was a rangy, intelligent woman with widespread interests, among them the Russian language, which she had learned to speak quite well. Her father had been employed by the Agency for International Development, regarded by many as a source of cover for the CIA. Her brother-in-law was employed by the same agency in the Washington, D.C. area. It was on Ruth Payne's way back from a long vacation, during which she had visited her in-laws in Washington, D.C., that she made the stop in New Orleans to pick up Marina Oswald and her daughter for the return to Dallas. I wondered vaguely whether Mrs. Payne herself had been manipulated in the course of this move. When Marina and her daughter reached Dallas, Mrs. Payne made them at home in her house in Irving, a Dallas suburb. She and her husband, Michael, had separated temporarily, so there was sufficient space for guests. On October 4th, Lee returned to Dallas. He spoke of having been in Houston looking for work. 10 days later, Ruth Payne obtained an interview for him, and he got the job at the Texas School Book Depository. For reasons that remain unclear, Oswald rented a series of small rooms in Dallas while his wife and daughter stayed at Payne's house in Irving. Although Lee kept a number of his personal possessions with him in Dallas, Mrs. Payne made her garage in Irving available to him for other possessions. There was no way of guessing what Lee Oswald had in mind with this odd living arrangement, nor who suggested it. However, it was undeniable that this situation worked to the advantage of whoever was behind the assassination. When the president was killed, the scapegoat appeared that much more removed from his family and friends, feeding this image of the lonely, crazed gunman. As a routine matter, I wanted to examine the income tax returns of Ruth and Michael Payne, but I was told that they had been classified as secret. In addition to the Payne's income tax reports, Commission Documents 212, relating to Ruth Payne, and 218, relating to Michael Payne, also had been classified as secret on the grounds of national security. Classified for the same reason were Commission Documents 258, relating to Michael, and 508, relating to Michael Payne's sister, as well as Commission Documents 600 through 629, regarding relatives of Michael Payne. What was so special about this particular family that made the federal government so protective of it? Even the DuPonts and the Vanderbilts would not have rated this kind of caring guardianship. I wondered if such paternal concern might be related to the fact that the CIA had come to be, for obvious security reasons, a family-oriented organization. While his wife and daughter stayed with Ruth Payne, Lee Oswald himself, according to the government, was in Mexico City, allegedly contacting the Soviet and Cuban embassies and making himself quite visible. But I was already having doubts about this explanation. Those doubts were confirmed later, when more information on this incident became available. A CIA memo dated October 10, 1963, reported that, in late September and early October, Lee Harvey Oswald had repeatedly phoned and appeared at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City, asking if there had been calls for him and talking with a trade consultant who was supposedly a member of the KGB's Liquid Affairs, or Murder Bureau. Copies of the memo were sent to the FBI and the State Department. Follow-up agency leads placed Oswald in the Cuban embassy as well, where he ostensibly was trying to obtain a visa to go to the Soviet Union via Cuba. Early in the official inquiry, the CIA informed the Warren Commission of Oswald's alleged activities in Mexico City before the assassination. Uncharacteristically, the commission asked for more evidence. Perhaps the commission members, aware that the agency had 24-hour photographic surveillance of the Cuban and Soviet embassies in Mexico City, were hoping for a good picture to shore up their sparsely documented account of Oswald's trip to Mexico. Initially, the agency ignored the commission's request, but after more pressure, the CIA finally handed over a murky snapshot of a portly, graying gentleman, almost old enough to be Oswald's father. This, the agency claimed, was Lee Oswald at the Cuban embassy. The agency also produced a statement from Sylvia Duran, a Mexican who worked at the Cuban embassy, alleging that Oswald had appeared there. However, the circumstances under which the statement was obtained were tainted, to say the least. On the day after the assassination, the CIA ordered Mexican authorities to arrest Duran and keep her in isolation. The agency cable said, "With full regard for Mexican interests, request you ensure that her arrest is kept absolutely secret, that no information from her is published or leaked, that all such info is cabled to us." Duran was not released until she identified Lee Oswald as the visitor to the Cuban embassy. After her release, the CIA ordered her jailed again. These circumstances were not known to the commission. Moreover, in 1978, Duran told author Anthony Summers that the man who came to the embassy was blonde, and about her own height, which was 5'3". That can hardly be said to be Lee Oswald. The commission did not question the Cuban consul, Eusebio S.Q., even though he had three angry confrontations with quote-unquote Oswald. But the House Select Committee on Assassinations did. When S.Q. was shown photographs of Lee Oswald, he stated that the young man who visited the embassy was blonde and was not the man in the photographs. Nor, said S.Q., was he the man he saw Jack Ruby shoot on television only 2 months after his face-to-face confrontations with this Oswald. The allegation that Oswald had been phoning and showing up at the Soviet embassy did not hold up too well either. There were no photos, and when the commission asked to hear tape recordings of Oswald's calls, the agency claimed in one case that surveillance was suspended and in another that equipment was not working. However, the tape survived long enough for the FBI agents who were present during the infamous 12-hour post-assassination questioning of Oswald to hear them. These agents, according to an FBI memo dated November 23, 1963, and obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, were, quote, of the opinion that the above referred to individual, the one on the Soviet embassy tapes, was not Lee Harvey Oswald, end quote. This evidence, which came out years after my official investigation was over, suggests to me not that Lee Harvey Oswald had been in Mexico City, as the Warren Commission concluded. Rather, it strongly suggests that Lee Oswald was impersonated in Mexico City, as Edwin Juan Lopez, who ran the House Committee's extensive Mexico City investigation, believes. This would be consistent with other impersonations of Oswald in New Orleans and Dallas that were carried out in an effort to set him up as a patsy. Some of the scenes were so preposterous that only the most gullible could swallow them. One of these tableaux occurred in the Mexican consulate in New Orleans. It was the early afternoon of a mid-September day in 1963. A young man, accompanied by a woman with a scarf tied around her head, appeared at the consulate. On this occasion, Mrs. Fenella Farrington happened to be there to see about getting her family automobile returned from Mexico. It had been left there on a recent visit with her husband. The young man asked the clerk at the desk, "What is the weather like in Mexico City?" "It's very hot," she replied, "just like it is here today." He then asked her, now striking the sinister theme repeated throughout these pageants, "What do you have to do to take firearms or a gun into Mexico?" This was a question that would catch almost anyone's ear. The lady at the consulate asked why he wanted to take a gun, and Fenella Farrington, standing nearby, volunteered that, "The hunting's wonderful." The man, whom Mrs. Farrington described as tall and very thin, seemed resentful of her contribution, making no effort to show any sign of appreciation. Mrs. Farrington also recalled that he appeared ill at ease and not relaxed, as were the other tourists seeking visas. 4 days after the president's murder, Mrs. Farrington was visiting relatives in Washington, D.C., when the FBI hunted her down. The FBI agent who called her from the Washington office gave her the office phone number so that she could call back for confirmation of his identity. This done, he informed her that the Bureau had located her because of the scene in the Mexican consulate in New Orleans. The scene had been photographed, he informed her, by an invisible camera. It had been set in operation when the young man mentioned firearms, and, inasmuch as she was present, the Bureau had traced her from the photograph. The young man, he added, was Lee Harvey Oswald, whose picture had been taken at the same time. The FBI agent suggested to Mrs. Farrington that she had also seen Lee Oswald in Mexico City, even before the scene at the consulate. She replied firmly that she had not seen Oswald in Mexico City. Nonetheless, the agent insisted, despite her repeated denials, that she had met Oswald in Mexico. Mrs. Farrington and her cousin, Mrs. Lillian Merrill, who had been with her in the Mexican consulate, later were questioned again by the same FBI agent and others as well. This time, the agents produced photographs of Jack Ruby and now insisted that Ruby had been present in the New Orleans Mexican consulate earlier that day when both Mrs. Farrington and her cousin were there. Both Mrs. Farrington and Mrs. Merrill informed the agents that the photographs of Ruby did not depict anyone they saw at the consulate. I heard of her story from Mort Saul and Mark Lane, who were working with us at the time. Lane took a statement from her at my request. He showed her 17 photographs, asking if any of them appeared to be the young men at the consulate in New Orleans. She replied that two of the pictures could have been the man. She picked out a picture of Lee Oswald, and she picked out a picture of Carrie Thornley, Oswald's friend from the Marine days back at El Toro, who had later moved to New Orleans. The Farrington affair raised obvious questions. Why, for example, was the FBI trying to bully a witness into saying she saw Oswald in Mexico City? And why was there no picture of Oswald at the consulate? The hidden camera there obviously was good enough to take an identifiable picture of Fenella Farrington and good enough to have the Bureau on her heels in a short time. The FBI agent told her that it had a photograph of the young man who wanted to take a rifle to Mexico, and that it was Lee Oswald, yet the government had never released that photo. If the photograph had been of Oswald, would the government have been so shy about revealing it? But the scene at the Mexican consulate in New Orleans was only the first of several suspicious incidents in which a highly visible Lee Oswald, quote-unquote, caught an observer's attention with a provocative action. In late September of 1963, another such incident occurred, this time in Dallas. A Leon Oswald appeared at the home of Sylvia Odio, an emigre from Cuba, with two Spanish-speaking guerrilla types. One of the two later phoned her, telling her of how crazy Leon was and how he wanted to kill the president. The following month in Dallas, Mrs. Lavelle Penn found three men ostentatiously firing a rifle on her property and chased them away. After they left, she found an empty cartridge case bearing the label of Man Liquor Carcano, the archaic and almost useless rifle which, the Warren Commission would announce, Oswald used in his historic exhibition of marksmanship at Dealey Plaza. In early November, a young man using the name of Lee Oswald applied for a job at a parking lot at the Southland Hotel. During the course of his conversation with the manager, he asked if there was a good view of downtown Dallas from the building. These scenarios were about as subtle as roaches trying to sneak across a white rug. But the most preposterous incident of the bunch took place one afternoon in early November of 1963. A young man arrived at the downtown Lincoln Mercury dealership, which happened to be just across the way from where the assassination soon would occur. He announced his intention of test driving and buying a car. The salesman, Albert Bogard, showed him a red Mercury Comet, and in short order they were cruising along the Stemmons Freeway, the customer at the wheel. After they got onto the freeway, he revved up the speed to 60 and 70 miles an hour and began driving like Mario Andretti at the Indy 500. He had the car taking even the tightest turns at high speed. As the salesman afterwards told his boss, he drove like a madman. When they got back, the customer seemed unhappy upon learning that he would have to pay at least $200 or $300 as a down payment to drive out with the brand new car. Eugene Wilson, another salesman, heard him say, "Maybe I'm going to have to go back to Russia to buy a car." The man then told Bogard that he would be back to get the car in a couple of weeks, that he had some money coming in. He gave his name as Lee Oswald, and Bogard wrote it on the back of one of his business cards. Several weeks later, Bogard heard on the showroom radio that Lee Oswald had been arrested. He pulled out Oswald's card, ripped it up, and threw it away. "He won't want to buy a car," he said. Bogard remembered the speed of the ride on the freeway better than he remembered the appearance of the customer. His response was, "I can tell you the truth. I have already forgotten what he actually looked like. I identified him as in pictures, but just to tell you what he looked like that day, I don't remember." Frank Pizzo, for whom Bogard worked, was much more positive in his recollection. The Warren Commission counsel, Albert Jenner, after unsuccessfully showing him a number of pictures of Lee Oswald with other men, finally showed him a photograph of Oswald taken on November 22nd after his arrest. And there's an author's note after the end of that sentence. Let me read it. "It's interesting to note that after Oswald's arrest, the FBI, which had been informed immediately after the assassination of the Lee Oswald visit to downtown Lincoln Mercury, did not take any of the witnesses from the automobile dealership over to Oswald's lineup." That is interesting. Wow. Here is the dialogue which followed. Mr. Pizzo: "Well, he certainly don't have the hairline I was describing." Mr. Jenner: Mr. Jenner's one of the Warren Commission counsel, by the way. "Mr. Jenner, this was taken the afternoon of November 22nd in the Dallas police show-up." There's a note here. There's a little bit more discussion that's off the record, and there's also discussion between Counsel Jenner and Counsel Davis and the witness, Mr. Pizzo, off the record. Mr. Jenner then says, "Back on the record, you can recall him as being more in the neighborhood of what, 5 feet 8 inches, 5 feet 7 inches more or less, or more or less?" Mr. Pizzo responds, "Between 5 feet 7 inches and 5'8 and a half, with a sort of a round forehead and a V-shape, is the thing that I remember the most." Mr. Jenner: "You mean a widow's peak?" Mr. Pizzo: "Yes, but very weak." Mr. Jenner says, "Very weak." Mr. Pizzo responds, "Very weak, but not the bushy type that I see in the picture. Well, if I'm not sure, then I have to say that he is not the one, if you want the absolute statement." That's the end of that transaction or dialogue between them. Back to the text. "So much, it would seem, for any likelihood of Lee Oswald himself having been the wild driver at downtown Lincoln Mercury. Oswald was 5 feet 11 inches tall. Eugene Wilson, a senior car salesman at the dealership, disagreed even with Frank Pizzo's recollection of the young man's short stature. Wilson said that the young drag racer had been well under 5'7 to 5'8. Wilson, who was 5 feet 8, said that the man who called himself Oswald was only about 5 feet tall. While the commission simply bypassed Frank Pizzo's precise testimony, it initially did not present Eugene Wilson's testimony at all. Consequently, Wilson is not listed in the index to the hearings. Later, just as the commission's report was about to go to press, Wilson was discovered, presumably by accident. The belated FBI interview of Wilson, then a car salesman with another Mercury dealership, clearly bothered the interviewing agents. It not only eliminated the possibility of Oswald being the young visitor, but underscored the probability of a pretender using Oswald's name. The FBI report emphasized that Wilson had a problem with his vision because of glaucoma. However, he was still selling automobiles, and it was fair to conclude that he could tell when another man was a good deal shorter than he. The commission loftily stated that it had carefully evaluated the downtown Lincoln Mercury incident, quote, "because it suggests the possibility that Oswald might have been a proficient automobile driver and, during November 1963, might have been expecting funds with which to purchase a car," end quote. Had the commission said that it had carefully evaluated the incident because it indicated that Oswald had shrunk considerably in height, this would, at least, have been more relevant. All these heavy-handed tableaux, from the Mexican consulate in New Orleans to downtown Lincoln Mercury in Dallas, confirmed my initial instinct that someone had been impersonating Oswald, and now the reason was obvious. A trail of phony, incriminating evidence had been carefully laid down prior to the execution of the president, leading to Oswald as the scapegoat. At the same time, the real Oswald had been manipulated by his intelligence community babysitters. De Morenshield had convinced him to move to Dallas, and then Oswald had been dispatched to New Orleans for sheep-dipping, courtesy of Guy Bannister. When Oswald returned to Dallas, other guiding hands made sure that he would be at the right place at the right time. Ruth Payne was the one who helped him get the job at the Texas School Book Depository. And, although Oswald was called at the Payne household about a better job at the airport, he was never told about it. Consequently, Assassination Day found him still working at the depository on Elm, the fateful side street that the presidential motorcade took that morning. I found myself wondering more and more about the accumulating signs of Oswald's manipulation. He was like a pawn on a chessboard, going where he was told to go, ending up where he was placed. When had the manipulation begun? Were there some early signs of it? My mind was taken back to El Toro Marine Base in California, even before Oswald's trip to the Soviet Union. I thought about Carrie Thornley, the one Marine whose testimony about Oswald was so different from that of the other Marines. I read through Thornley's testimony again in Volume 11 of the hearings, all 33 pages of it. Most of the testimony of the other Marines around Oswald had been reduced to half-page affidavits, but Thornley had been kept on the stand longer than most of the witnesses in the entire inquiry. I had my staff begin inquiring about him and learned, to my surprise, that Thornley, who had been in the Marines with Oswald in 1959, had arrived in New Orleans as far back as 1961. In our routine check of police records, we found that he was also in New Orleans in 1962. He had been arrested in August for putting a sign on the telephone pole on Royal Street in the French Quarter in violation of a city ordinance. We located the arresting police officers. When questioned, however, they no longer could recall the subject of the sign Thornley had posted. From his own admission, as well as from statements of Barbara Reed and a number of others, we learn that Thornley had been in New Orleans in 1963. Finally leaving the city only a few days after Kennedy's murder. Reed, a longtime French Quarter resident who had both known both Thornley and Oswald, described seeing them together on several occasions. One of them was in early September 1963 at the Bourbon House, a combination bar and restaurant in the French Quarter. Thornley, who usually wore his hair extremely long, had just returned from a trip out of town. This time, he was wearing his hair unusually short and closely cropped, as Oswald invariably did. Reed recalled having said to them, "Who were you guys supposed to be? The Gold Dust Twins?" We were eager to talk to Carrie Thornley, but he was not an easy man to locate. Took us a lot of legwork and more than a year to do it. We had investigators going to every place in the French Quarter until we had learned what had been his main hangout, Ryder's Coffee House. Except for occasional visits to the Bourbon House on Royal and Bourbon Streets, Thornley seldom went anywhere else. Ryder's Coffee House had been small, dimly lit, and most unprepossessing. He wondered how such a small place, serving mostly coffee, had survived. However, rent was low at its Vaucarie location, and apparently beer and wine sales kept it going. Thornley was very much into conversation, and Ryder's was a place where young people gathered to talk. When Writers closed down, its regulars simply moved to nearby places. We picked our most sociable investigators and had them canvass a small cluster of bars that had sprouted up near the old Writers. A large number of the patrons knew Thornley. When our investigators found someone willing to help us, they would bring him in to see me, and we would have a casual talk. It was all most unauthoritarian, extremely relaxed, and very productive. While Thornley did not seem to be a person inclined toward deep relationships, he had an unusual facility for developing widespread, casual relationships. Moreover, Thornley, who moved around quite a bit, was that rarity of the 20th century, an inveterate letter writer. From his friends, we obtained a letter here, a postcard there, no address stayed at very long. However, mostly they came from three cities, Atlanta, Los Angeles, and Tampa, Florida. When we finally caught up with him, he was living in Tampa. It was early 1968, and our case was very far along. I had a grand jury subpoena served on him, and a few weeks later, we had Carrie Thornley visiting the Criminal District Court building in New Orleans. When he arrived, I talked to him briefly. He was quite amicable, even talkative. He said that he had arrived in New Orleans in February of 1961, the month after the Bolton Ford incident, and had been living in New Orleans from that time until late November 1963, a few days after the assassination. He had no reason for leaving at that odd time. He just decided that the time had come to move. He was surprisingly candid about having met both Guy Bannister and David Ferry while in New Orleans, although he described those meetings as brief. He denied having met Oswald during that period when both were in New Orleans. I had learned that virtually all of the young men connected with Guy Bannister's operation, most of whom appeared to be employees of the intelligence community, carried a box key for the Lafayette Square post office. I never learned exactly why, but probably it was for receiving mailed instructions from their intelligence case officers, or to provide an explanation for their periodic presence in the building where the Office of Naval Intelligence was located. Fishing, I asked Thornley why. When he lived in New Orleans, he carried a box key for the Lafayette Square post office. He promptly replied that he had possessed such a key because he lived just across the street at the Fox Hotel, and it was convenient for him to receive his mail at the post office. It was something of an eyebrow raiser to learn that, upon his arrival in the city in February of 61, Thornley had moved right into the heart of the intelligence community. However, my eyebrows went up even farther when I learned that while in New Orleans, he had been writing a novel inspired by Lee Oswald. He finished the book in February 1963, just 9 months before the assassination. Not many individuals were writing books inspired by Lee Oswald, at least not before President Kennedy's murder, that is. One of the reasons I had developed an interest in Thornley was that I suspected he could have been the man who used the name Oswald at the Bolton Ford Company in January 1961. He had to have been one of the few men in the world who was in New Orleans around that time, who knew Lee Oswald, and who knew Oswald was in Russia. In addition, Thornley bore a striking resemblance to Oswald. They were of approximately the same height and slight build, both brown-haired and had similar facial features. I recalled Thornley's testimony concerning their respective heights. Warren Commission Counsel Albert Jenner asked how tall Lee Oswald was. Here is the exchange that resulted. Mr. Thornley: I would say he was about 5'5", maybe. I don't know. Mr. Jenner: How tall are you? Mr. Thornley says, I'm 5'10". Mr. Jenner asks him, Was he shorter than you? Thornley replies, Yes. But Oswald had been the taller of the two. Why, then, had Thornley described his friend Lee as 6 inches shorter than he really was? Was Thornley perhaps fearful that someone might believe that he had been the young man who acted out the role of Lee Oswald in the early 1960s at the Bolton Ford in New Orleans, and then in Dallas, and then again in New Orleans, and then in Mexico, and then in Dallas again? During my brief questioning of Thornley, I did not mention his statement that Oswald had been much shorter than he, saving that for the grand jury. I did have time to ask Thornley about his travel schedule in 1963. He said that in the late spring, about the beginning of May, he had gone by bus to visit his parents in California. I asked him whether or not the bus had stopped at Dallas, and he replied that it had. He acknowledged having visited Dallas briefly on that occasion. It was about that time that the grand jury was ready to go into session, so we entered the conference room for several hours of testimony by Thornley. Afterwards, upon reflection, the timing of Thornley's trip to Dallas struck me, although I had said nothing about it while we talked. The Oswalds had just moved from their Neely Street apartment in Dallas to New Orleans in late April, leaving some rent still paid for. Consequently, the Oswald apartment had been left unoccupied for some days. Considering their respective travel schedules, Oswald and Thornley had not been very far away from passing each other on the highway, each one in the opposite direction in his respective bus. I was also aware that at some unknown time, apparently when Oswald was not there, a young man of Oswald's build, wearing a pistol on his hip, had posed for several photographs in the backyard of the Neely Street apartment. Do you see where this is going, folks? Do you know what picture we're going to be touching on here, I have a feeling? Let's find out. In one picture, he held aloft a rifle and a copy of the communist newspaper, The Daily Worker. In the second picture, he held a rifle and a copy of The Militant, also a left-wing newspaper. These incriminating pictures, purporting to be Oswald, had been found in Ruth Payne's garage in Irving, where presumably she had been keeping them for him. When, on February 21, 1964, one of the pictures exploded on the cover of Life magazine, some people decided the case against Lee Oswald was indisputable. But for most people with common sense, including me, the combination of the brandished rifle and the communist newspaper raised more questions than it had answered. At first glance, the photographs appeared to be of Lee Oswald. However, after study, it was apparent that in each picture, Oswald's face did not precisely fit the neck and the body. Furthermore, the facial portrait of Oswald was exactly the same one in each photograph, whereas the picture in the distance of the body from the camera differed. In addition to that, using the length of Oswald's face as a standard of measurement, one of the bodies in one picture was clearly taller than the corresponding body in the other picture. There's an author's note here. Let's go down to the bottom and read it. The Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations each concluded that these were genuine photographs of Oswald, taken before the assassination. However, Robert Groden, the photographic consultant to the House Committee, wrote a dissent printed in the appendix to the committee's hearings. Groden stated, quote, "In my opinion, no matter what the panel members concluded, the backyard photographs are beyond question fakes. For the record, the method used here was, almost without doubt, simply posing a man in the backyard with a rifle, pistol, and publications as part of this original picture. The only item added was the head of Lee Oswald from the middle of the chin up. In the absence of a rational explanation..." I'm sorry, that's the end of the quote. "The only item added was the head of Lee Oswald from the middle of the chin up," end quote. "In the absence of a rational explanation for such a suicidal picture-posing session on Oswald's part, and none was offered by either the Warren Commission or the House Committee, Groden's conclusion that the photos were fakes remains more persuasive to me." Interesting. I think Stone included that in his movie. that they point out that that picture is phony, that many, and I've seen Jim Mars, rest in peace, also make that case too. He showed how composites were taken, the left side of a face and the right side of another face were fused together and made to look like Lee Harvey Oswald. Anyways, continuing on, back to the text. Of course, had the photographs actually been the real Oswald posing prior to the assassination with a rifle in his hand, this would have been in conflict with human nature. It is very rare, if not unheard of, in the annals of assassination for the assassin to be to provide so much incriminating evidence against himself in advance. It seemed plain enough to me that this was just another part of the process of setting up the patsy. Thornley had told me that he returned from his summer in California by way of Mexico City. This happened to be very close to the time that the Warren Commission said Oswald was in Mexico. By November 1963, according to his own account, Thornley was living in a New Orleans apartment he rented from a man, John Spencer. We located Spencer, who turned out to be a friend of Clay Shaw's. As he described it, sometimes Spencer visited Shaw, the director of the International Trademark, and sometimes it was vice versa. Spencer told us, however, that Shaw never came by while Thornley was living at his place. Several days after the assassination, Spencer told us he came to his house and found Thornley gone. In Spencer's mailbox was a note from Thornley saying, "I must leave. I'm going to the Washington, D.C. area, probably Alexandria, Virginia. I will send you my address so that you can forward my mail." Spencer said it was quite unexpected because Thornley had at least a week left in the months before his rent was due. He went to Thornley's apartment, number C, and found that paper had been left over the entire floor, torn up into small pieces like confetti. Before being torn up, the paper had been watered down so that the ink was blurred, making it unreadable. Spencer said he had some conversations with Thornley about his book, The Idle Warriors, and that Thornley asked him to read a copy of the manuscript, which had been turned down by several publishers before the assassination. Spencer never did get around to reading it. After the assassination, Thornley told Spencer he was going to be a rich man because of the coincidence of Oswald having been the subject of his book. I later sent Andrew Sciambria, to the Washington area, where he traced Thornley's path. Thornley had wound up at Arlington, a Washington suburb, and had moved into the Shirlington House, a first-class apartment building where he worked as a doorman. Thornley stayed at Shirlington House for 6 months until he testified before the Warren Commission. Oddly enough, his salary was less than the rent of his Shirlington House apartment. Gee, imagine that. In the mid-1970s, when I was in the private practice of law, Thornley sent a lengthy, almost biographical 50-page affidavit to me describing, among other things, evidence he had encountered in New Orleans of quote-unquote, Nazi activity in connection with President Kennedy's murder. It was apparent that even though I no longer was district attorney, Thornley wanted to assure me that he had not been involved in Kennedy's assassination in any way. Although it did not accord with reality, as I recalled it, the affidavit had, in retrospect, one interesting feature. Purely gratuitously, it mentioned how Thornley had left Washington following his Warren Commission testimony and ultimately returned to California, where he and John Roselli, is that Handsome Johnny, happened to become friends. The affidavit was mailed to me before Roselli's name surfaced during the Senate's 1975 investigation of the CIA's assassination practices. Roselli, it turned out, had been one of a number of mobsters with whom the agency had developed a relationship during its pre-Castro activities in Cuba. Now, there is an author's note at the end of this last sentence. Let me read the note. Roselli's gambling proclivities in pre-Castro Cuba, the site of numerous casinos, later made himself useful to Howard Hughes, the eccentric billionaire. With Roselli and his connections to ease the way, Hughes moved into the twinkling world of the Las Vegas casinos, buying up whatever caught his eye. It was while he was working for Hughes, and because of his background and gambling contacts in Cuba, that John Roselli was enlisted by the CIA. Back to the text. After the Cuban Revolution, Roselli's assignment from the agency was to assassinate Fidel Castro. To this end, during 1962 and 1963, Roselli was given poison pills, explosives, rifles, and handguns. However, nothing seemed to work out on the Cuban end. The last effort in this CIA-Roselli combine ended in mid-February 1963, apparently because conditions were not right, quote-unquote. But Roselli was not as closed-mouthed about his mission as the agency would have liked. When he appeared before a Senate committee investigating the assassination proclivities of the CIA, Roselli testified that he was aware all along that his murder project was sponsored by the agency. Not long afterwards, the remains of Mr. Roselli, garroted and stabbed and cut in pieces, were found floating in an oil drum in Dumbfounding Bay off the Florida coast. Federal investigators were unable to find any leads to the perpetrators. This did not prevent the Justice Department from indicating that it thought the job was... the work of organized crime. The CIA said it thought so too. It did not seem to have occurred to federal investigative authorities that the mob would not likely have been the unhappy party as the result of Roselli admitting to the Senate that he had initiated assassination attempts for the CIA. Whether the murder of John Roselli was an old-fashioned gesture on the part of the mob or a clever example of what the agency terms damage control, it is clear that in the middle 1960s, when Carrie Thornley met Roselli, he hardly was becoming a friend of the average American citizen. Even after Carrie Thornley's appearance before the grand jury, the strange intersections between his life and Lee Oswald's remained enigmatic. Was Thornley an agent of the intelligence community? Had he impersonated Oswald or coached others to do so? Did he know more than he was saying? I did not know the answers back in the late 1960s. And the whole bizarre saga of Thornley became even more enigmatic when we later discovered a letter he had written to a friend in Omaha, Nebraska, writing in February 1964, a few months after his arrival in the Washington, D.C. area, Thornley made a brief reference to President Kennedy's assassination. Here is that excerpt. "The whole thing was very interesting for a while, the assassination, because, on the surface, there was good reason for the unenlightened SS, whatever that means, and FBI to suspect I might have had a hand in it. We had some polite conversations, and finally, I guess, I was cleared. No word from them lately. I hope, though, my move to this area scared the piss out of them. Whether or not I'll be asked to put in my 2 cents at the Warren hearing, I don't know. Or care. When it is all over, though, I may yet go piss on JFK's grave. R.I.P. Boy, I do not know what to make of that. Okay, that's the end of Chapter 5. This was extremely interesting. I had been doing some other study and listening to some other people. Some other people that I might add claim to be the one of the shooters, one of the gunmen, in Dealey Plaza. His name is James Files, and he admitted in 1994 and then 2003 with Tex Mars and Vim Dankbar that he was friends with Johnny Roselli and what's another one, Charlie something, that they were part of the Chicago mob and they were sent to be gunmen in the JFK assassination. So John Roselli, Handsome Johnny, I think they called him, I didn't know Jim Garrison was aware of him. That's incredible. I did not expect to read that. Okay, let's move on. Let's keep going here. We can go another 11 pages and hit chapter 6. Chapter 6, Deep Cover. "Hey, my man," Dean Andrews had said to me. He was a roly-poly lawyer who spoke in a hippie argot all his own. "We've been friends since law school days. Why do you want to treat me like I've got leprosy?" "Because you keep conning me, Dean. You admitted to the Warren Commission that on the day after the assassination, while you were a patient at Hotel Dio Hospital, you were called on the phone and asked to fly to Dallas and be Lee Oswald's lawyer. When the Warren Commission asked you the caller's name, you replied that it was Clay Bertrand." "That's right," he said. "Now, when I tell you I want to know who Clay Bertrand is, you tell me he's a client of yours, but you really don't know what he looks like because you've never seen him." "Scouts on him, my man," Dean Andrews said. "That might have been good enough for the Warren Commission, Dean, but it's not good enough for me," I replied. The puffy, oval face opposite me assumed a look of wounded pride. At least, what you could see of it did. A large part of his face perpetually was concealed by huge black glasses, the kind that let him see you, but it did not let you see him. He wore them always, sunny days, cloudy days, outside, inside. I think he slept in them. After some nights of reading Andrew's testimony before the Warren Commission, I had arranged for him to meet me for lunch here at Broussard's restaurant. This was back in early 1967 when I was still frustrated with our futile search for Carrie Thornley. Based on the Warren Commission testimony, I thought Andrews might lead us to an even more important witness. Broussard's was one of the older places in the French Quarter. The bottom half of the walls around us was of veined marble. The top half was mirrored. The walls had been that way for close to 100 years, and except for the regular polishing of the mirrors, nothing ever changed in the place. It was one of the least crowded French restaurants, a good place to meet for a quiet conversation. It was a meeting I still recall vividly. In my reading, I had learned that, at the time of the first FBI interview shortly after the assassination, Andrews had described Clay Bertrand, his New Orleans caller, as a man approximately 6'2" in height. He had gone on to say that Bertrand was a man who called from time to time to help young friends of his who had become involved in minor scrapes with the law. Then, and later in more detail, he explained that in the summer of 1963, when Lee Oswald was living in New Orleans, Bertrand had called him and asked him to help Oswald with some citizenship problems his wife, Marina, was having. Oswald, consequently, had met with Andrews several times at his office. It had readily become apparent to me, however, that the more Andrews realized that his having received a phone call to defend Lee Oswald was a potential danger to him, the foggier the identity of Clay Bertrand became in his mind. By the time Andrews appeared before the Warren Commission in July of 64, Bertrand's height had shrunk from 6'2" tall all the way down to 5'8". Apparently in response to subtle pressure from the FBI agents, Andrews told them, "Write what you want, that I'm nuts. I don't care." The agents obligingly wrote in their final report that Andrews had come to the conclusion that the phone call from Bertrand had been a figment of his imagination, quote-unquote. This not only allowed the Bureau to conclude its investigation into Andrews, but harmonized with its announced conclusion that Lee Oswald had accomplished Kennedy's assassination alone and unaided. I knew Andrews well and had known him for years. He had been at Tulane Law School at the same time I had been there, although we were not in the same class. His practice was focused toward the municipal courts, and he appeared to obtain much of his business from his regular presence in some of the more offbeat bars in the city. From reading his statements and subsequent testimony, it was clear to me that Andrews indeed had received a phone call from someone in New Orleans about going to Dallas and defending Oswald. and it had come the day after the assassination. Andrew suddenly leaned forward, his black glasses looming at me. "Pipe the bimbo in the red," he said in a low voice. "What's that?" I glanced in the direction he was pointing and saw a lissome young lady radiant in crimson, turning heads as she arrived with her lunch date. "She's pretty," I said, turning back to Andrews. His laid-back manner, which seemed to enable him to shed reality as a duck sheds water, was beginning to irritate me. I had been trying to pin him down for a half an hour now, and he was well into his second martini, quite unfazed. "Could we get to the point? Just who is Clay Bertrand? Where do I find him? I want to talk to him." Andrew swung his arms wide in exaggerated frustration. "God almighty," he said. "You're worse than the Phoebes." There's a note here after Phoebes. Phoebes meant FBI agents in Andrew's special language. "How can I convince you that I don't know this cat, that I don't know what he looks like, and I don't know where he's at? All I know is that sometimes he sends me cases. So one day this cat Bertrand's on the phone talking to me about going to Dallas and representing Oswald." He put his hand over his heart. "Scout's on him, man. That's all I know about the guy." I'm sorry, guys. John Candy's way better at Dean Andrews than I am. Andrews resumed eating his crab meat, Louie, with gusto. Apparently he felt that I had my answer and the matter was settled. For the first time it occurred to me that seated in front of me was a man who took everything in life with a grain of salt. Or perhaps, I reflected, he had up to now. As he lifted another forkful of his crab meat, Louie, I reached out and grabbed the fat hand with the fork in it. The black glasses swung my way. The crab meat halted in midair. "Dean," I said, "I think we're having a communication problem. Let me see if this will help clarify it for you. Now stop eating that damn crab meat for a minute and listen to me." I could not see through the glasses, but I knew I had his attention. "I'm aware of our long friendship," I said, "but I want you to know that I'm going to call you in front of the grand jury. If you lie to the grand jury as you've been lying to me, I'm going to charge you with perjury. Now am I communicating with you?" Andrew stopped eating his crab meat and put down his fork. He was silent for a long moment, apparently saddened at the failure of his jive humor. Then he spoke, and for the first time he seemed to be serious, at least as far as you could tell before the black glasses blocked your vision. "Is this off the record, Daddy-O?" he asked me. I nodded. "In that case," he said, "let me sum it up for you real quick. It's as simple as this. If I can answer that question you keep asking me, if I keep giving you that name you keep trying to get, then it's goodbye, Dean Andrews. It's bon voyage, Dino. I mean like permanent. I mean like bullet in my head, which makes it hard to do one's legal research, if you get my drift. Does that help you see my problem a little better?" Out of the corner of my eye, I saw blue flames flare up. I glanced over to the nearby table. A couple was having crepes, Suzette's, and the waiter had just lit the brandy. He hovered over the burning dessert with great ceremony. I leaned forward. "Read my lips," I said. I spoke with careful deliberation. "Either you dance into the grand jury with the real moniker of that cat who called you to represent Lee Oswald, or your fat behind is going to the slammer. Do you dig me?" Andrews froze. I could not read through the huge pitch-black glasses, but I sensed that he was shaken. Then he stood up so suddenly it startled me. "Do you have any idea what you're getting into, my man?" he asked me. "You want to dance with the government? Is that what you want? Then be my guest. But you will get sat on, and I do mean hard." He dropped his pink napkin on top of his crab meat, Louie. "Thanks for the lunch," he mumbled. "It's been lovely." He wheeled and walked away from the table. When he had entered the restaurant, he had jigged in the front door, snapping his fingers to some imagined tune. Looking at him as he walked away, I realized that I had finally gotten through. He was not jigging anymore. My office's search for Clay Bertrand began with a discussion by our small group of the backpedaling by Andrews, as described in the Warren Commission volumes, away from any clear identification of the man. We came to a general agreement that because Andrews himself was known to be a frequenter of some of the bars deep in the French Quarter, such places could be a fertile field for inquiry. It was plain enough that Andrews knew the man who had called him, and the association well might have derived from one of those places where he hung out. By that time, Andrew Ciambra had become a member of our investigative group. Ciambra had grown up and had lived much of his life in the Sixth Ward, which included a large part of the Lower French Quarter, where the bars Andrews patronized were located. Over the years, Ciambra had come to know one and then another operator or employee of these various bars. To ease the entree of our people at locales was not always enthusiastic about the arrival of law enforcement and enforcement personnel. We planned for Ciambria first, and in some cases, friends and acquaintances of his, to contact the various bar owners in the lower part of the quarter. That done, we formed teams of one assistant DA and one investigator each. Here's a sentence in parentheses. In this instance, to cover the large area involved, we borrowed liberally from our entire attorney and investigative staff. To sweep the bars and ask if any proprietors knew of a man who used the name Clay Bertrand. On the first night of the hunt, I went out with one of the teams to one of the bars deep in the quarter. This particular place, Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop, had been a popular watering hole for classmates of mine back in Tulane law school days, and I had the distinct impression that I had seen Dean Andrews there, even though that was some years before. When we arrived at the blacksmith shop, I saw that it had changed very little. It was held to be the locale at which Jean Lafitte, the famous pirate whose headquarters was on Bayou Barataria, just outside New Orleans, actually maintained a blacksmith shop. The place was built around a huge open fireplace and chimney and was constructed almost entirely of ancient brick. It appeared old enough, given the benefit of occasional rebuilding over the years, to have been standing there since the War of 1812. There was a definite air of intrigue about the place, emphasized by the low ceiling and the thick, uneven rafters which had been hewn by hand rather than cut by machine. From the gas-lit lanterns behind the long wooden bar to the chimney lamps at each table, there was not an electric light to be seen. It took very little imagination, amid this unique atmosphere, to envision the pirate, Jean Lafitte, meeting there with representatives of General Andrew Jackson. Jackson's great victory in the Battle of New Orleans has been attributed by some to these meetings, at which he obtained from Lafitte much-needed flints for his rifles. Unfortunately for our particular expedition, the old owner of the place, who had always been friendly to me, had died a year or two back. The new owner, while friendly enough on the surface, seemed very nervous. Besides, while he was beaming welcome from ear to ear, I'd noticed that he had eyes like an anxious barracuda. They definitely were not responding warmly to me. It was evident immediately that I was going to get nothing from him. He had no idea who Clay Bertrand was, he said, adding with emphasis that he had never heard the name. As we left the bar, Lou Ivan came over. "Look, boss," he said gently, "I know you'd rather have me come straight out with this. You're showing up with us like this without any warning just about gave that man a heart attack. Seeing the DA suddenly walking in doesn't make too many people happy in this area. I think you better leave this operation to us." So I did. The rest of the sweep was handled by members of the group. Most of them were better than I was anyway in establishing quick, casual relationships. These were long evenings for the staff members engaged in the hunt. It was not the kind of thing where one could pop in a place and then pop right out again. Even with Ciambra's help, relationships nevertheless had to be developed at each place visited. If the owner was not there, then it usually meant having to have a few beers while chatting with the bartender. Our investigators learned to go straight to the bar stool nearest the cash register, which resulted in more chances for casual banter with the person tending bar. At the end of the first week, all the scouting patrol had to show for their late nights was a collection of baggy eyes. A number of the owners and bartenders seemed to know well enough who Clay Bertrand was, but they felt a professional obligation to protect him as a regular client, and none whatever to help us. Still, we pushed on. Then, at some point, along about the third week, we had our first break. At Cosimo's, a small, crowded tavern deep in the quarter on Burgundy Street, the bartender had been friendly and receptive on the first encounter, but indecisive about knowing who Bertrand was. On the follow-up visit, he was cooperative. An uncle of Ciambra's had called him on the phone. "Sure," he said. "Bertrand comes in here a lot. I guess you might say that this is a regular stop of his." "Did he know whether Bertrand used another name?" "Oh, sure," he said. "Clay Shaw. I think most people know that." He went on to mention having seen him on the TV news, usually with important people. He could not understand, however, what the mystery was. As far as he was concerned, everyone in that part of the quarter knew Bertrand. Did he know why Shaw used the name Bertrand? The bartender shrugged. All he knew was that it had been that way for a long time. After that, two more bartenders, from places deep in the quarter, cooperated in quick succession. Clay Bertrand? Sure, they knew him. Everybody around here knew him. His other name? Clay Shaw. Everybody knew about that. The general feeling seemed to be that Shaw used his pseudonym as some kind of private game, something for his own satisfaction. No one at these bars had any idea why he chose to be Bertrand when visiting their places, but that was good enough for them. Shaw was not particularly discreet in the use of this alias, but he appeared to use it only in the raffish bars in the lower quarter, where his presence might well have tarnished his public image as a prominent civic leader. Gradually, my men began encountering one person after another in the French Quarter who confirmed that it was common knowledge that Clay Bertrand was the name Clay Shaw went by. However, no one would authorize the use of his name or even sign a statement to be kept confidential. No one wanted to get involved. This was quite curious, considering Shaw's reputation throughout the city as a man of decorum and distinction. Finally, we located a young man named William Morris, who had met Shaw at the Masquerade Bar on St. Louis Street in the French Quarter. He had been introduced to Shaw by Jean Davis, who worked at the Court of Two Sisters. Davis had introduced Shaw to Morris as Clay Bertrand. Morris had become a friend of Shaw's, not only visiting Shaw's apartment, but encountering him at one private party and, on occasion, again at the Masquerade Bar. Morris said that his tall friend was always referred to as Bertrand. Then, in a break from a far different direction, the lady who had been the hostess at the VIP room from 4 Eastern Airlines at New Orleans International Airport called us. She had been on duty when a man, apparently meeting a friend who had arrived by plane, signed the guest register as Clay Bertrand. From some acquaintance, she had heard that the DA's office was looking for a man by that name. The name had stuck in her mind, she said, because each VIP room visitor was supposed to sign the register before leaving. Only this man, not his friend, had signed before they left. She looked at his signature, which she customarily did, and she saw the name Clay Bertrand. We followed up with a search through the airline's guest registers. As her memory became more specific, the search narrowed down to the sign-in registers for a period of a few months, and then the signature was found. After the printed phrase, "visiting guest," there was signed with a flamboyant flourish, Clay Bertrand. Her description of the signer was a tall, elegant, white-haired man with distinguished bearing. Obviously, Clay Shaw. Things began to pick up. One lead led to another, or two or three. This was taking weeks, but the team was making steady progress. And slowly, ever so slowly, we were getting a signed statement here, a signed statement there. Our patient, plodding footwork had taught us that Clay Bertrand was actually Clay Shaw, the distinguished director of the International Trade Mart in New Orleans and a civic leader of note. But at that time, we had no inkling that Clay Shaw was much bigger and more powerful than his New Orleans persona indicated. It was not until much later, well after the Shaw trial, when it could have been of any use to us, that we discovered Shaw's extensive international role as an employee of the CIA. Shaw's secret life as an agency man in Rome, trying to bring fascism back to Italy, was exposed in articles in the Italian press, which we had obtained from Ralph Schoenemann, secretary to the philosopher Bertrand Russell, who had been one of the earliest supporters of our investigation. Wow, interesting. According to these articles, the CIA, which apparently had been conducting its own foreign policy for some time, had begun a project in Italy as far back as the early 1960s. The organization, named the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, World Trade Center, had initially been formed in Montreal and then moved to Rome in 1961. Among the members of its board of directors, we learned, was one Clay Shaw from New Orleans. The Centro Mondiale Commerciale's new headquarters, according to the Roman press, was elegant. Its publicity, announcing the new creative role it was going to play in world trade, was impressive. The Centro opened an additional office in Switzerland, also an impressive move. However, in 1967, the Italian press took a close look at the board of directors of the Centro Mondiale Commerciale and found that it consisted of a very curious collection of individuals. The board contained at least one genuine prince, Gutierrez di Spadaforo, a member of the House of Savoy, whence came Umberto, the last of Italy's kings. Spadaforo, a man of considerable wealth, with extensive holdings in armaments and petroleum, had once been the undersecretary of agriculture for Il Duce, Benito Mussolini. Through his daughter-in-law, Spadaforo was related to the famous Nazi minister of finance, Halmar Schacht, I hope I'm saying that right, who had been tried for war crimes in Nuremberg. Another director of the Centro was Carlo Di Emilio, the lawyer for other members of the former Italian royal family. Another was Ferenc Nagy, the exiled former premier of Hungary and the former head of its leading anti-communist political party. Nagy was also described by the Italian newspapers as the president of Permindex, ostensibly a foundation for a permanent exposition and offshoot for the Centro Mondiale Commerciale. Nagy, the Italian newspapers said, had been a heavy contributor to fascist movements in Europe. Yet another director was a man named Giuseppe Zigiotti, the president of something with the congenial title of the Fascist National Association for Militia Arms. One of the major stockholders of the Centro was a Major L.M. Bloomfield, a Montreal resident originally of American nationality and a former agent with the Office of Strategic Services, out of which the United States had formed the CIA. There's an author's note here. Let me read it. This was significant not only because of his espionage background, but because of a curious non-scheduled air trip taken by Clay Shaw and David Ferry to Bloomfield's home city of Montreal in early 1961 or 1962. See more in Chapter 9. Back to the text. This, then, was the general makeup of the Centro Mondiale Commerciale on whose board of directors Clay Shaw served. Judging from the background of its members and the fairly heavy activities in which they were engaged, the organization could not be confused with the Shriners of the 4-H Club. The Centro was described in 1969 by writer Paris Flammonde in The Kennedy Conspiracy as apparently representative of the paramilitary right in Europe, including Italian fascists, the American CIA, and similar interests. He described it as a shell of superficiality, composed of channels through which money flowed back and forth, with no one knowing the sources or the destination of these liquid assets. The Italian government had no problem distinguishing the organization from the Shriners and the 4-H Club. Before 1962 was out, it had expelled the Centro Mondiale Commerciale and its half-brother, Permindex, from Italy for subversive intelligence activity. Perhaps because of its Montreal origin, the Centro aroused the interest of a Canadian newspaper, La Devoir. Referring to Ferenc Nagy, one of the Centro's directors, it wrote in early 1967, Nagy maintains close ties with the CIA, which link him with the Miami Cuban colony. Nagy subsequently emigrated to the U.S., making himself at home in Dallas, Texas. With regard to Major Bloomfield, Le Devoir observed that although now ostensibly a Canadian, he had been involved in espionage in earlier years for the U.S. government. It went on to point out that Bloomfield was not only a major shareholder of the Centro, but of its affiliated group, Permindex, as well. Summing up the fate of the two related enterprises, Le Devoir stated, "Whatever the case may be, the Centro Commerciale and Permindex got into difficulties with the Italian and Swiss governments. They refused to testify to origins of considerable amounts of money, and they never seemed to engage in actual commercial transactions. These companies were expelled from Switzerland and Italy in 1962, and then set up headquarters in Johannesburg." The ultimate evaluation of Clay Shaw's Centro Mondiale Commerciale by the Pesa Sera stated, "Among its possible involvements, supported by the presence in directive posts of men deeply committed to the organizations of the extreme right, is that the center was the creature of the CIA, set up as a cover for the transfer of CIA funds in Italy for illegal political espionage activities. It still remains to clear up the presence on the administrative board of the center of Clay Shaw and ex-major of the OSS, Bloomfield." Pesa Sera made an additional observation about the Centro. It was, the newspaper observed, the point of contact for a number of persons who, in certain respects, have somewhat equivocal ties, whose common denominator is anti-communism so strong that it would swallow up all those in the world who have fought for decent relations between East and West, including Kennedy. That just happened, as well, to be a trenchant one-line description of the parent organization, the Central Intelligence Agency. As for Permindex, which Clay Shaw also served as a director, the Italian press revealed that it had, among other things, secretly financed the opposition of the French secret army organization to President de Gaulle's support for independence for Algeria, including its reputed assassination attempts on Charles de Gaulle. This observation, had we known about it in 1967, would have brought us full circle all the way back to the blimp base at Huma, Louisiana, where David Ferry and others from Guy Bannister's operation repossessed the munitions from the Slumberger bunker with which the CIA earlier had given to the assassination-minded OAS. It would certainly have helped our case against Shaw to have been able to link him definitively with the CIA. Unfortunately, however, with our limited staff and finances, many leads to follow, our investigation was not able to uncover any of this crucial background information when we needed it most. Okay, that is the end of Chapter 6. We'll pick up next time with Chapter 7, The Front Page. Until next time, this is Ted Midward signing off. Take care, God bless, bye-bye.